You've probably heard me talk about my dog, Jackson. He's my baby boy. And as he's gotten older, he's gotten really finicky about eating. He used to get so excited about food, he'd literally spin. Well, not anymore. In fact, I often have to spoon feed him to get him to eat. Well, no more. Not since we started feeding him fresh food made with whole ingredients, backed by veterinary science. It's Nom Nom. Now, I actually tried making food for him myself. I'd cook up big batches of chicken or beef with vegetables and rice or potatoes, but without knowing what I was doing, he wasn't getting the vitamins and minerals he needed, and certainly not in the correct balance. That's all changed now with Nom Nom. Go to trynom.com, trynom.com/sentbynicole. They'll ask you some questions about your pup and tailor a specific amount of individually packaged Nom Nom meals and send them to you. By using my special URL, trynom.com/sentbynicole, you'll get 50% off of your first order, plus free shipping, and it's a great way to help support this show, too. Again, that's trynom.com/sentbynicole. Plus, Nom Nom comes with a money-back guarantee. If your dog's tail isn't wagging within 30 days, Nom Nom will refund your first order. No fillers, no nonsense, just Nom Nom. Welcome to a very special edition of the Nicole Sandler Show. I have one guest today, and though you may not know his name, you certainly know his work. We delve into the world of music with a legend. I'm so excited to welcome today's guest to the show, Bob Ezrin. I can only describe as a legendary record producer, but as you'll hear, he's a whole lot more than that. And we go way back, though it's been about 20 years since we've seen or spoken to each other. And that was when we were internet radio pioneers together.
Yes, we were.
So in addition to, I mean, we know you, Bob Ezrin, for producing artists and albums. Pink Floyd's The Wall, of course, is the one that is probably most top of mind, but Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, Peter Gabriel, and the list goes on from there, and we'll talk about some of those. But I also want to talk about, the other things that you've done that people may not be as familiar with. Starting with, let's talk about how we were internet radio pioneers. So we met each other back in the 90s and early 2000s when I was still living in Los Angeles, and you had gone off and formed this company called Enigma Digital. Where did Enigma come from?
Well, there was an Enigma Records, if you remember.
I do.
And that was the Hein brothers, Bill and Wes Hein, who were friends of mine. They and a couple of other people and I got together, and we were talking about where we saw the world going, particularly in terms of the explosion of interest in online stuff. And this was around the dot-com bubble, when everybody was doing something and they were all posting billion-dollar valuations for no revenue and all that. But we had this crazy idea that people might want to connect with each other through the internet based on their shared interests and stuff. We didn't know what social media was, and we didn't call it that, but we called it affinity groups, which was, basically groups of people who shared a love for something. And we thought, since we're all kind of music people, that we would start there, but that was never meant to be the end all, and that we would have online radio stations, and that those would attract an audience, and the audience would then have places to talk to each other, to share ideas, to post things, stuff. We were ahead of our time, as I have generally been in my career, and I've got the arrow wounds in my chest to prove it. And but it was a really cool idea, and we had some amazing backers and people who believed in us that got us through. We actually survived Black Tuesday, you may recall, Nicole, and which was, for your listeners, that was the day in April of 2001 when the dot-com bubble burst, and suddenly things like pets.com, drugs.com disappeared.
Right.
Just went from billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar valuations to zero, and we were kind of among the last people standing. And in fact, we ended up getting bought by Clear Channel, and many of us had to sacrifice our bodies to indentured servitude in order to keep the lights on. But it was worth it. It was a good idea, and from it, a number of stars emerged, yourself included. And if you remember Michael Abrams, who was the I guess he was the COO, technically speaking. And then, basically he was my collaborator in the running of this thing and a brilliant guy, and went on to, be at Disney. And now he's at Live Nation. And many of our people went on, and Rob Jones, who had KNAC, and with whom we partnered on KNAC.com. Now he's got a speaker company and he's doing great. And, so many of the people that were there at the time have gone on to do bigger and better things. And that makes me feel great.
Well,
that's the best thing one can do.
I look back on that time, obviously, very fondly. And what happened from my part is years earlier, we had put a AAA station on the air in Los Angeles, KSCA. Then once the Telecommunications Act passed, 1996, and the consolidation frenzy started, where smaller radio groups were gobbling up the bigger ones because the ownership rules had changed, our station, KSCA, was bought, sold for a ridiculous amount of money, and went away. And a few years later, or 2 years later, Clear Channel decided, well, we'll put another AAA station on the air in Santa Monica. They took these two smaller signals that were both at 103.1, one in Newport Beach, one in Santa Monica, and put Channel 103.1 on the air. And then, of course, as consolidation continued, Clear Channel and AM/FM merged, and they had too many stations in Los Angeles. So we were the logical ones to be sold because we were two signals, and we were a niche format, AAA adult album alternative that never got great numbers, though we had quality listeners. And so my general manager, Charlie Riley, and I took a pitch to the Clear Channel higher ups and said, let us take this online. Let us go internet only. We'll make history. We'll be the first station to go seamlessly from over the air to internet only. And we got tons of national press. You can still look it up. I found Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, LA Times articles still on the internet today. So that's interesting. And then you were just down the street with Enigma Digital, and you had KNAC.com and Groove Radio and Luxurium Music, I believe. You already
Correct.
Going, right? And then one
and
day
we had Afterlife as well. We had Afterlife, which was a freestyle hip hop station, and that was pretty cool.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and I wasn't
aware of that at the time. And then I got introduced to you by Charlie Riley, not realizing we had met years before, and we'll talk about that in a bit too. But and then this partnership happened. We moved into your studios, which were I loved them. That was the cool from our studios over the hearing aid shop in Santa Monica into your beautiful Enigma Digital studios. And then, the dot-com bust happened. And then one day I got called in and was like, you're all gone. So I'm sorry, you're all fired. We were left, but you still kept going with KNAC.com and the other stations. In fact, I think Rob was given the task of taking over the programming for worldclassrock.com that we had become. And he's like, I don't want to do that. That's what they do. It was a sign of the times because
that was after
too early.
We had sold to Clear Channel. That was after and not something that I could. I couldn't protect
you, Nicole.
Oh, I know. Let me tell you something. There was an interesting thing, and the viewers or listeners are probably bored silly with this stuff, but it is interesting. You start up a company, you get a backer, you get a VC, a venture capitalist, to put up some money, and then you hire a bunch of staff and you create your product, and then you go out and you try and generate revenue by doing really cool things that people come to see, and then you want to go to advertisers and other people like that and try to make money. And we were running out of money right at the time that Black Tuesday happened in 2001, when the whole thing blew up. And our venture capital person, the first investor in us, which is Vantage Point Venture Capital, the managing partner there, walked me around a golf course. This is literally true. Walked me around a golf course and said, "Well, you know, Bob, sometimes you're in a perfect storm, and this is a perfect storm. Wow. And so, you know, maybe it's time to just walk away." And I went home, and I sort of thought about it overnight, and I woke up the next morning and went, "Hell no, there's 65 people working here. And it's not their fault that we haven't been able to generate enough revenue. They're doing their job." So then I went into a process of kissing frogs, as you would say, until I found our prince, right? And our and we had some great support from companies, you know, a company that came forward and gave us a bridging loan, which you know, just to get us to the point of sale. And then we got bought by Kevin Mayer, who at that time was the chairman of Clear Channel Interactive, and who later on went on to be the number three guy at Disney.
Oh, wow.
And briefly became the CEO of TikTok. And then he resigned when there was a controversy with the U.S. government. Anyway, enough of that stuff.
Wow.
Let's but go on to what the audience
right.
cares about.
Well, it is fascinating. And they do care about this because it is history. And the fact is that it took a long time then for we didn't call it streaming radio then. It was internet radio. We had special gadgets to listen because we didn't even have broadband then. It was still dial-up.
It was higher speed dial-up, so it was like 128, and it was sounding but not unlistenable. But it wasn't just about the radio, right? It wasn't just about the streaming. It was the idea of gathering people in a place online where they could be with other people like them, and they could talk about the stuff that they cared about. That was a revolutionary idea, and that went on to become actually the engine for the affinity groups for the radio stations all across Clear Channel's network of 1,200 stations.
Wow.
So they used our, the software that we created and our data. We basically built what's called a relational database, and they used our database across that whole thing. And then they used our database for their ticketing effort, which was early on. And then when they spun off the concert promotion business, they took that with them, and it became Live Nation, and the rest is history.
It's so amazing when you look back on it, because so much time has passed, and you know, it's like when you as we get older, we gain weight, we lose weight, lose hair, we get grayer, and we don't notice it as we're going through it, but then all of a sudden, it's 30 years later, and you look back and you say, "Oh shit. Wow, look what happened." You know, all these things have changed. And so even to the point where Bob Ezrin, as I started, you are a legendary record producer. Even the act of producing an album is totally different now than it was 30 years ago now, because the equipment is different. The technology is different, right?
Yeah, the process is different. The act is not, not to argue semantics, but the basic act of making something is you have an idea, and then you figure out how to realize that idea, and then you create it, and then you put it out into the world, right? So that has not changed. We have ideas, we have creative people who want to accomplish certain things, and they come to people like me who have some experience and whose work they've seen, and they can relate to, and they ask us to help, right? And in some cases, I've been really maybe the most thankful person you've ever met, because I just have such a wonderful life as a result of a great deal of good fortune and the goodwill of so many people. right? And I'm eternally grateful for it. But, you know, one of the things I'm thankful for is that the people that I've worked with, for the most part, 99.9% of the people I've worked with have been really wonderful people and incredibly talented, and who have been, if not secure enough within themselves, at least have felt secure enough within our relationship to trust me to help them to get them to that spot. So it's not an argument most of the time. There are arguments. There's always arguments, and there's always differences of opinion about whether something is good or not good. But, you know, to be in a position to be able to work with such, you know, really special, uniquely talented people, and to participate in their creative process to help guide them to the finish line from the idea that they had to the realization of it, to getting it out in the world. That's a privilege. That's a total privilege.
And you earn it. You don't just walk into a position like that where you command that type of respect and people listening to what you have to say. You get there based on your work and experience. Now, Bob Ezrin, you started very young, and you came from a very talented, artistic, musical family, right? So it was in your blood. Was there ever any question that you would have a career in the music industry somehow?
I think, I don't know about the music industry, because I started off wanting to be in theater.
Yeah.
And that was sort of my dream. I wanted to be in theater either as an actor or a director, anything. I just wanted to be there because I loved the immediacy of it and just the way that it ignites imagination and evokes, you know, these huge feelings in people. I just thought this was like, it's alchemy. It's magic. You take these, you know, very base components and you turn them into some kind of creative gold. So, in fact, I wrote a little bit about it. I'm not writing a book.
I was going to ask.
Although
you should.
Although I might be writing a book. But I don't know.
I'm writing a lot.
And one of the things that I wrote to remind myself was when my parents took me, first of all, they used to take us to Stratford, Ontario, here with the Shakespeare Festival. Oh. And that experience of going into theater in the round with great actors and watching, and Shakespeare is all imagination. There's, you know, when they talk about battlefields, you know, you don't have 600 extras on the stage and horses and stuff, but you imagine it in your mind through the language that Shakespeare wrote. And these amazing Shakespearean actors coming from all over the world to this festival, I was transformed by the experience, really, because suddenly theater was in my head, and I imagined everything as a play or a film or something like that. It was all about theatricality. And then we went for a trip to New York City when I was, I want to say, 12. Mm-hmm. And we went to see a Broadway play. And that blew my brains out. We went to see The Bells Are Ringing with Judy Holliday.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, it's a long time ago, like 1961.
Okay.
Before most of these people were born.
Right.
1961 on Broadway. And there, on the stage, were these amazingly talented people who could sing, they could act, they could do stuff, and like a ton of beautiful women dancing. And for me, as a prepubertic, you know, kid from the boonies, like to come down and see that, I couldn't believe that such a thing could exist. But anyway, you know, just the romance of it, of seeing people on a stage, you know, singing and dancing and doing all these wonderful things and reading this wonderful text that had been written for them and stuff, and making us laugh and making us cry and making us stand up and applaud at the end of it, that whole experience to me, that was where I wanted to live.
Huh.
That was it. I wanted to be that guy in that place. And music was a left turn.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because you did do some television as a kid up in Canada where you're from, you and your siblings. And so it was a natural, or you said it was a left turn. But so what got you into the music?
It was theater. I was doing a show. I was doing a musical review in Toronto that was kind of a yearly comedic musical review that would come out in spring called Spring Thaw. And we killed Spring Thaw. We had the worst show ever. And our show was the last Thaw there ever was. But I was on the team, and I was actually like the script editor, meaning I was putting together all these sketches and stuff for this sketch show. I hired Lorne Michaels.
Wow. That's
yeah, and he was in a I hired him and his teammate. He was in a comedy team called Hart and Lorne, with a guy named Hart Pomerantz, whose brother Earl Pomerantz went on to be a big time TV comedy writer and stuff. And of course, we know what Lorne has done. And we had a bunch of really talented people in the show, but at some point, we all agreed we need a rock score, like, you know, the old musical stuff, boring. Let's get a rock band and let's do rock music. And at that time, Michael Cole, who you know, is arguably the greatest promoter in history, and I co-managed a band in Toronto called Icarus, the lead singer of which was Eddie Schwartz, who wrote Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
Okay.
And Michael Cole went on to promote Pink Floyd, the Rolling Stones, U2, Barbara Streisand, you know, you name it. And the people that are running Live Nation used to work with Michael at Concert Promotions International here in Toronto. He started it, and they worked for him at the time. So he's like legendary. But at that time, we were just, you know, we were kids. And he thought managing the band meant booking them in clubs, and I thought it meant working on their music. So that's what we were doing. And then we get this band the job on this show. They come in, and the music director of the show, Alan McMillan, sort of let me go and, you know, just said, okay, well, you seem to have an affinity for this stuff. So you do a bunch of stuff and then bring it to me and I'll let you know what I think. And I did. And he said, I think you should meet my partner, Jack Richardson, who was at the time the producer of the Guess Who. At that exact moment, they had a single called American Woman and were number one in the world. Mm-hmm. They were the number one band in the world. And this guy, Jack Richardson, was talk about legendary producer, maybe the greatest producer Canada has ever seen. And so that's how it happened. I was working on a stage show. The music director said, I want you to meet my partner, Jack Richardson. God bless him. I went to see him and I said, I want to be a manager. I want to work with bands and I want to work on their music. And he goes, whoa, wait a minute. You don't want to be a manager. You want to be a producer. And I said, okay.
Okay.
Yep, that's what I want to be. You know, whatever you say, sir. So, and then he took it on himself to mentor me, and I shadowed him for months. He sent me off to a 2-week boot camp at Eastman School of Music with Phil Ramone.
Oh, wow.
Talk about legends. Yes, Phil Ramone had this 2-week course in production and engineering, and Dave Green was his second in command. Dave Green from A&R Studios, like him, in New York City. And they liked me. They saw something in me, and they gave me extra attention and time at the console and stuff like that. That was a transformative experience. Those 2 weeks made me a record producer.
So then how long was it between that and when you, I guess, found Alice Cooper? Because you went out, you saw him, you were supposed to say, we're going to pass, and but you liked what you heard. And that started a lifelong relationship.
It was literally, I mean, I met Jack, I think, in May. I went to the Eastman School in the summertime. It would have been June or July. And September 8th, I was sent to New York City to get rid of Alice Cooper. They had come into the offices and they decided they needed that Guess Who sound. Uh-huh. And Shep Gordon, the manager of the band, went to see Jack. He brought in pictures of this band of five creatures of indeterminate gender, you know, in their clown suits and things like that.
And at that time, the band was called Alice Cooper. There was not a single person named Alice Cooper.
No, he was called
Alice.
He was.
Okay. He was.
Yes. But the whole band was called Alice Cooper. And he had to change his name to Alice Cooper because their publicist said, I don't know how to deal with a band called Alice Cooper when there's no Alice Cooper in the band.
There you go.
So they kind of drew lots, you know, and he got the gig. He was the right one. He was the lead singer.
Of course.
But Shep said they wanted Jack to produce, and Jack just looked at these photos. Jack was a very conservative man, and he looked at these photos and listened to the music, and he didn't get it. He didn't like it.
Wow.
But they sent me, and as a group, everybody sort of agreed, no, this is not for us. So, as you know, but they wouldn't take no for an answer. So Jack said, well, I'll send the kid.
Yes.
And if the kid likes him, then I'll go see him. And then maybe we'll have something to talk about. And then they sent me to basically get rid of him. And I went to Max's Kansas City on September 8th, 1970, and walked into this place, this club filled with people in spider eyes and spandex with black fingernail polish and jet black hair and black lipstick and high-heeled boots. And they fairly flew across the floor like they were some kind of zombies, you know, or you know, vampires or something. I mean, they were from another race altogether, not human. And then they put me in at a table right in front of the stage, and I got to see this spectacle, this show that they put on. They came out in like silver lamé suits, the band.
Wow.
And Alice was in his ripped leotard with, you know, blood red gums and spider eyes and a sword, you know, and a cane and a hammer.
Wow.
And proceeded to frighten the shit out of me. But at the same time, you know, completely seduced me, right? So the show was amazing, and they had props and they had a beautiful lighting show, and it was very theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
Right up my street, right? I liked the idea of working with music, but I also really loved theater,
right?
And so by the time the show was over, I was just like, I love that. And so I went running up the stairs at Max's Kansas City to the dressing room, and I just said, we'll do it. We will do it. We'll produce. We think you guys can make hit records, as though I knew what that meant. You know, I didn't have a clue. And they said, well, that's good, because we think you guys can too. And we all hugged, and I love you, man. I love you. I can't wait. You know, and then I went outside, and I realized I am so fired.
So you go back and you say, wait, they were great. We got to do this. And
I went back and I basically, you know, argued for my life. And Jack said, well, if you believe in it that much, then you should do it.
You should do it.
And you should do it.
Uh-huh. And you did it.
And I said, okay. And as I have done my entire life. You know, that's one of the things, like when I you know, I have a school as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when talking to the students, you know, I would always say, you know, that there's a famous poster of a grizzly bear that's standing in front of a waterfall. He's like this, and his mouth is wide open. And coming off the waterfall is a salmon heading straight for him, right? And I say, be the bear, you know, put yourself in the path of opportunity. Never say no. You know, even if you're not really sure whether you can or can't do something, you know, what's the risk?
Fake it till you make it, right?
Fake it till you make it, or at least try. You know,
learn as you go.
Learn as you go. I think faking it sometimes does a disservice to everybody, including yourself.
I agree, but no, you got to learn as you're going. But if you wait until
really work to get it right,
sure.
But take the opportunity.
Always, Always.
And yeah, always. So that was an opportunity that Jack offered me, and then he backed me up and he mentored me through it. And he believed in me. And Jack Richardson is really the father of this amazing career that I've had for the last 52 years, you know, of being able to do pretty much all the things I've ever dreamed of, you know.
That's incredible. Amazing. When you can bring it back to that one person. He gave you the room to do it and to learn the craft and to succeed at it. You know, Alice Cooper, I was young when the first records came out, and his image scared me, as I guess it was supposed to. But the music, to me, it was incongruous, because the music was always so, even the harder rocking songs were very melodic and very accessible, and it didn't fit that image, but it made you remember, oh, that's Alice Cooper. And still to this day, I mean, when he came out as I think King Herod in the Jesus Christ Superstar televised,
wasn't that great?
Yeah. You know, I loved that movie as a kid.
That was so great. You know what, I ran into into Tim Rice, Sir Tim Rice, who wrote the libretto for that, for Jesus Christ Superstar. We were both in London, and we were both heading out to see We were both heading out to see Deep Purple play at the O2. At the O2 arena. Deep Purple, who I've had the privilege of working with for many years now. But I hadn't seen Tim in a long time, and I just wanted, you know, like, hey, how are you? And he said, wow, wasn't Alice amazing? And Superstar, and I said, it was like you wrote the role for him. He said,
perfect.
I did, you know, in a way, right? But yeah, he was brilliant at that. It was really, that was a fantastic role for him. And I think it reignited some interest in him, that along with the Hollywood Vampires, amongst a younger set of people. And he's out there, like, he's still playing 150, 200 gigs a year.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. And the music
is timeless. And we're still making records.
That's great. So this is a long relationship that you've had, and through some amazing albums. I mean, it was Million Dollar. I keep wanting to say Billion Dollar Babies, I guess, because the time.
It was Billion Dollar
It was Babies. Billion. Okay, I'm thinking it was Million. It was Billion.
No.
Memory. It should have been Billion, I guess. All right, so we're speaking with Bob Ezrin. So Alice Cooper was what propelled you into, you know, hit records and
within the first four songs that they allowed me to do. At that time, they weren't prepared to invest in an entire album once they found out that, you know, there was this kid involved. You know, they were like, who?
So Bob, you started with four songs.
And, so they let us do four songs, and one of the four songs was I'm 18.
Oh, God. Wow.
And you know, that was a pretty undeniable record, and became his, you know, that was his first hit. It was my first hit. It was my first production. And lucky me, you know, that thing got picked up by Rosalie Tremblay at CKLW, the Big Eight in Windsor, Ontario, that beamed into the Detroit Metroplex to an audience of 6 or 7 million people and started the ball rolling in North America. You know, once that started happening, Cleveland picked it up, then this one, then that one. And next thing you know, it was all over rock radio in the U.S. And it wasn't even a number one or anything
really?
Like that. It was, I think it wasn't even a top 10 record, but it got enough airplay that it ignited interest in the band, and it moved records. We, you know, we had a gold album, our first.
That's amazing.
And back in those days, that was 500,000 copies, and that was an amazing, you know, feat at for first time out. So,
sure.
Yeah.
And it opened the door for everything else to happen.
A lot of stuff.
So was Lou Reed next? Or what was it? Because then you were propelled into the stratosphere of rock superstardom, from Lou Reed to Kiss to Peter Gabriel.
I did a few things in between. Like, I did an album with an artist in New York called David McHugh. That was my next production. And that was my first time working with an orchestra and stuff in a studio. And Dave Green was the engineer on that, the same guy who had mentored me during the summer. So that was a terrific experience. And then from that, we started up the next Alice Cooper record because every 9 months they wanted an album in those days.
Yeah.
So we started up the next Alice Cooper record, and then I got a call asking if I'd be interested in producing Mitch Ryder and the band Detroit.
Okay.
So I did Detroit in Detroit, and one of the songs on the album was Lou Reed's Rock and Roll.
Okay.
And in that band, by the way, was a sort of ratty-looking guitar player from Decatur, Illinois, with Coke bottle glasses and, you know, shy as could be, but just a brilliant named Steve Hunter.
Okay.
And that was where my relationship with Steve Hunter began, was doing the Detroit album. Steve Hunter came up with the riff for Rock and Roll, and Lou Reed heard that version and said, that's the best version anybody's ever done of one of my songs, and I want that guy. So that's how the Lou Reed connection started. And talk about connections like that. I went to see Lou Reed play at Massey Hall in Toronto, and that was the night that we met. And the opening act was Genesis.
Oh, okay. That was Peter.
Which I've been hearing a lot about because they've been playing them on FM in Toronto, and Chum FM, the station in TO then. And so I wanted to go see the opening act, and I did, and I watched as Peter Gabriel took the stage, you know, in his batwing headdress and his, you know, kabuki makeup and strange moves. And just, he was so theatrical and so amazing. So I was very excited to be meeting Lou Reed and to be talking about Lou Reed's album. But I just said to myself, get me that kid with the flower on his head. I want to work with him, you know. And that was the beginning of the sort of, you know, the kind of supernatural trajectory into, you know, working with Peter Gabriel.
Wow. Now, it was
an amazing time.
You produced his first album, which was called Peter Gabriel, but not the second album that was called Peter Gabriel. I was just wondering about the name, the title of the albums. I always wondered why he named both of those records Peter Gabriel, but I guess I thought three, but it's been a while since I've done music radio. Three of them he called Peter Gabriel, I guess, because you can. So,
He's Peter Gabriel.
Exactly.
Because he can. Yeah,
he can.
Exactly.
He can. But you tell a story about Salisbury Hill, which I think was probably his first big hit single, about how you never got the final lyric down until like just as you were recording the song at the last minute. It's like it wasn't going to make it on the album.
Right. That album was an amazing experience, I think, for everybody involved. It was overwhelming for Peter. It was too much for Peter, which is why I didn't do the next one, because he just felt like, whoa, he'd been hit by a steamroller.
Oh, wow.
But we put together this amazing band, and Peter and I had worked together up until that point to make sure that we had the material for the record. And even to the point where he came to New York, where I was living then, and we found him a flat, and he would come to my house every day and sit at my piano and write, and I'd be up in the office. And every time I heard something I really liked, I would go, you know, record that. I gave him a little cassette machine and stuff. And then, we gathered up the material for the record. Then when it was time to make the record, I was really enjoying working live from zero, basically putting together an amazing group of people, come in with the material and just arrange it on the floor, record it on the floor, do it live. Of course, you know, we didn't have an unlimited budget. And in order to do that, that meant we had to move pretty quickly. And that meant I had to sort of, you know, Peter is very methodical. Takes his time, as you can tell, because it's like 8 years between records and stuff. But this one, you know, I had to push it through because we had a grand total from the time we started of about 12 weeks to get it done. So we were in Toronto with this amazing group of people, and we were putting these arrangements together on the fly. The arrangement for Salisbury Hill came together brilliantly, and that acoustic guitar part is historical. People just hear that guitar part and they know
that's it. Yep.
what they're listening to, right? And Larry Fast with his, you know, synthy stuff, and the way that Alan Schwartzberg played the not drum kit that I gave him to play. I took away his cymbals. I took away all this stuff. Anyway, uh-huh. So the song was great, but the chorus said, you know, the eagle flew out of the night, you know, he's something to behold, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, son, he says, the eagle says right. to the narrator, grab your things. I've come to take you home. That's the record line. That went out.
Yes.
But at that time, the line was, son, he said, make your life a taxi, not a tomb. I said, wrong. And Peter said, excuse me? Uh-oh. And I said, that's not happening. We're not putting that. That is not going on this record. I said, we need a better line than that, right? And it became kind of a game throughout the making of the whole record. But, okay, I've got one. Does anyone here know Officer Muldoon? No, that's not going to work. Okay, how about, and then we did. Then we decided, well, backwards masking. What about backwards masking? How about Strakeb Nadrokera Togvoy Loof, which if you turn it over says, fool, you've got the record on backwards. And nope, that's not going to work. And it went all the way to when we went back to New York to finish some overdubbing and mix the record. And Peter came in the room and said, I have it. Grab your things. I've come to take you home. And I said, that's it.
Wow.
That's the line. Okay, get in there and sing it. And he did. And we mixed it then.
And it's history. And
it's a magical song, brilliantly written, brilliantly conceived, beautifully played. And
You know, Bob Ezrin.
But it went so fast. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's no.
It went
please.
So fast that it was a little uncomfortable for Peter. And I think he felt that I didn't give him enough time to explore some of his own ideas. And I probably didn't, because I was of the barrel on through school of production. And hadn't worked with an artist like Peter before.
Well, you were still young, right? And you're learning the game and what works for you and how to make it happen. And you, as a producer, you also have to be very cognizant of the time and the budget and the studio time. And so you're doing your job and he's being the creative artist. So how do you get from Peter Gabriel from these beginning years and great success to Pink Floyd? How did Pink Floyd come about?
I had success with Peter. I had some big, you know, pretty big success with Kiss as well.
Very much
And the Lou Reed Berlin album, even though when it first came out, it didn't perform that well, it became a classic sort of, you know, soon after, and people uh-huh. started to refer to it as a creative, you know, some sort of creative milestone. And when we were in the early days of Nimbus 9, of my sojourn at Nimbus 9, when we were doing Alice Cooper, we were doing a lot in England, and I thought that there was a tremendous amount of potential in England for us to, you know, find bands to produce and so on. And I thought that we should hire a representative over there. So we had met Caroline Christie, who was working for Derek Taylor at Warner's in London at the time, and sort of doing publicity and artist relations and that sort of stuff. I really liked her. I thought she was talented, and she seemed to know everybody. Like, you know, little did I know that she was actually Lady Caroline Christie, and her brother Will was a famous photographer, and she was in the mix, right? But so we hired her, and she became our rep, and a good friend of mine, and very deeply involved in the Alice Cooper, in promoting Alice Cooper over there and so on. So she'd seen me work, and Caroline and Roger Waters started to date, and then they became fiancés, and then they got married. But just before they got married, Roger was toying with the idea of doing a project. The Wall was one of two things that he was considering at the time. But he needed help. He needed help in dealing with the other members of the band. At this point in his career, he was beginning to feel as though He was Pink Floyd, and the other people were almost an appendage. You know, oh, not wow. an appendage, but
bit players, the word I'm looking for.
You know, but they were bit players, but they were sort of an encumbrance, you know, to him and all of his creative genius. And Caroline said, well, and he said, you know, well, I can't do this alone because I'm going to need someone to deal with them and to help realize it. And she said, well, what about Bob? Which is a good title for a film, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, I that would work.
Write that down.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they were on tour and we met on the way from Toronto to Hamilton, Ontario in a limo, and we had a long conversation. Roger, I had actually met Roger before at a party at Caroline's house. And we talked about this project and that sort of led to them coming to me a few months later and asking me if I'd be interested.
And there's been a lot of stories written about the experience, and obviously overall it had to be positive because it's The Wall. Look what came out of that. But obviously you're dealing with a really strong personality in Roger Waters, David Gilmour too, I guess, in his own way. But you had to walk a very fine line. Roger Waters at one point said to you as you were talking about Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, that this could be a hit, and he said, "We don't do hits. We don't do singles.
We don't do singles.
We don't do singles." And you turned it into a single.
You know what? The one thing, again, you know, when I say it's like the barrel on through school of production, I've never really been afraid to express myself, you know, in situations. I mean, unless I thought it was futile, uh-huh. right? There have been a few places where I found myself where I just go, "There's no point in fighting because." You know, this person is either they're not going to get it or they just don't, you know, they've made their mind up and there's no point. But in this case, you know, I really enjoyed the partnership with Roger and the whole band, you know, and I fought for more involvement on David's part because, you know, I feel he is so much part of the voice of Pink Floyd. Yeah. Right. And Rick too. And for Rick. And of course, you know, Nick is. That sound, those drums, like that, the minute that those drums come up, you go, okay, that's Pink Floyd, you know. So I didn't have to fight for Nick. He's just, he inhabits that space. But you know, getting songs written by David Gilmour was, at first, you know, not necessarily high on Roger's list of priorities. But then we came up with, you know, literally, we had a script. I, you know, back to my theatrical sort of leanings, you know, I wrote a script for the eyelid movie of The Wall, not the movie.
Right.
But I wrote it as though this is the soundtrack for a film that I was imagining in my brain. And I wrote it out on yellow foolscap. I still have, I've got the script in my archives and stuff. And it gets to where Comfortably Numb is. And it says, song in D, you know, Pink reveals himself.
Okay.
And that was it. And, you know, and so, you know, and every day we would have tea up in the conservatory at the studio. We work from 10 to 6 every day, banker's hours, because they all have wives and children, and that's okay. The way they wanted to work, which I love, by the way.
Right.
To me, that's the best way to work. You set a time limit. You do it during the day, and you allow yourself to have a real life around it, and I think that makes for better creation. But anyway, so we'd have tea at 4 o'clock, and then we'd go back and have another hour or so, you know. And at tea one day in the conservatory, I said, you know, has anybody got? I mean, we need a song in D for this spot, right? And it has to say this, it has to tell this story. And Gilmour plays this kind of a love song on the high string.
Uh-huh.
He played that part that, you know, right? That's in the chorus of Comfortably Numb. And immediately you hear that, you just go, oh boy, that is fantastic. Let's make that into something. And then the challenge was to get Roger to collaborate with him because at first he wasn't inclined to do so, but then he did. And he came up with that lyric, which I think maybe to this day the greatest song lyric ever written. You know, there is no pain. Oh. You are receding. A distant ship, smoke on the horizon. You're only coming through in waves. Your lips move, but I can't hear what you're saying. When I was a child, I had a fever and my hands felt just like two balloons. Now I have that feeling once again. This is not me. You would not understand. This is not who I am. I have become comfortably numb.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Forget about it. I mean, that's just, I get goosebumps saying it to you now after all this time. Anyway, we're speaking of time.
And you got to get going, huh?
What are we going to do?
Let me play one quick thing for you. So back in 1992, almost 10 years before we meet at Enigma Digital, I'm producing the number one morning show, radio morning show in LA, the Mark and Brian Show. And Scott Page is a friend of the show. Scott Page, who played saxophone, most notably on tour, at least with Pink Floyd. He was the band leader for the Mark and Brian Christmas show every year and a friend of the show. And he's like, okay, I'm involved in this thing. It's seventh level. We're doing this music and technology thing together in Vegas. We want Mark and Brian to come and MC the thing. We don't really know what it is, but we go. And it's your thing. So can you explain what it is? And I'm going to play a little clip.
Well, we were raising, okay, so let's just say this first. What it was, we were doing a big concert at the Thomas & Mack Arena in Las Vegas during Comdex, which was the big computer trade show. 15,000 tickets, and we were raising money for the Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Okay.
And that was the pet charity of our partner, George Grayson, who had been a supporter of that for many years. So, and they would do events every year at Comdex when he was in the computer software, visual software business, and raise money for the center. This year they wanted to really blow it out. And we had gotten together and decided to do an interactive entertainment company. We wanted to push the boundaries of people's experience with the things that they love by making it interactive. Now that sounds, today that sounds
it's
like
nothing,
yup,
but
duh.
Then.
But then there wasn't any such thing. You couldn't, in fact, we created the first software, or George did, the first software that allowed animation on a desktop. There hadn't been any. It was just little green, it was those little green characters and stuff. So we were the first thing to have real animation moving around on a desktop. And then we found ways to interact with it, to cause it to do stuff. And so we made games and we made educational software. It was, it was really, it was a groundbreaking company, and this was our coming out party.
Right. And so there was a moment in here. So I was there with a camera at the rehearsal, and your animated interaction thing. Now when we look at it, it's like, yeah, what's the big deal? But back then, this was groundbreaking. So here's a little bit of it. You can see there's Mark and Brian on the, and there's you with a lot of hair.
That had never been done before.
Right. And so they were interacting with this character. It's hard to hear with the way the audio was, but they're reading the script.
They were talking to him and he was talking back. I mean, there was stuff like that at Disneyland and Disney World. They were experimenting with stuff, but most of their stuff was screen mapped. It was like projection on a surface. This is just computer monitors that we synced together so that they were showing different portions of the Eduardo character, and then you could talk to Eduardo and Eduardo would talk back to you. And that was fairly revolutionary, but that was, those were amazing days. And we invented in a way a new form of comedic entertainment anyway, because I went to my friends in Monty Python. And And I said, it started with Terry Gilliam. We were having dinner in London. And I said, Terry, you know, what you guys did to television, which was basically turn it on its head, how would you like to infiltrate and disrupt the personal computer by creating entertainment that is different from anything anybody's ever seen before? And he was fascinated. So we created Monty Python games. And computer nerds are notoriously Monty Python fans. They love it. So our games were like really successful. And we built a big company out of it.
Wow. And this thing, just so you know, I'm letting the video play. And there's Edgar Winter on the stage with Flo and Eddie are up there. It was an amazing, you had the part where the band was playing. You've got everyone from Todd Rundgren to John Anderson. There's you in the middle, sort of directing everything during this rehearsal.
John Entwistle was there.
Yeah, Jeff Skunk Baxter. Yeah. I mean, just the lineup there of talent. It was an incredible event. Looking back
That's Scott Page.
Yes.
And, maybe the best networker I've ever met. And he just, these are people he put, he told me who was coming. And I brought Peter Gabriel but he put this band together because he does that kind of stuff, doesn't he? And he would do that for you guys.
He did it every year for our Christmas show. Yeah.
Yeah. So I came in once the decision had been made to do this, and, this was before there was a Seventh Level. I was brought into conversations that turned into Seventh Level.
Okay.
But basically Scott called me, and Scott, buddy, I need your help.
Yeah.
But it's like, I got this big thing and it's getting out of control and stuff. So he asked me if I would come in and direct the show, which I was thrilled to do, had the best time, loved working with Scott. And then we ended up, Scott and George and I ended up becoming partners.
Wow. Well, it's amazing. My friend Bill Mumy, who was just on with me, says time is a something river. Time is a weird river or something. And it is. I mean, I'm forgetting the exact quote. A bizarre river. And it is. You look back on these things and some of it you don't even remember. And then it's like, I didn't even realize when I worked with you at Enigma 8 years later that you had been part of this event until I dubbed off the videotape a few weeks ago after finding it. So, and here we are 30 years. It was 30 years ago this month that event happened. And
wow.
Yeah, right. That's what I say. Wow.
But look at what's happened in just 30 years, the complexity and the transformative nature
everything.
Of technology now, the stuff that we do. I'm talking to you on my laptop, which also houses most of my entire studio and on which I'm, fixing and mixing big projects, film projects, records and stuff like that. It's incredible. Things that we never thought were possible in 1992.
Right, especially when you see how far we've come. This was the big technology showcase. You're seeing things that had never been done before, and here we are. You've got a whole recording studio on your laptop. Bob Ezra and I could keep talking with you for hours and hours. Behind me, I took a painting during the pandemic, and there's a painting, you can kind of barely see it. I don't know if you remember my dog, Sandy, but she was a fixture. And you're the one, I'm always grateful, and yet it still hurts my heart 20 years later. You're the one who told me that I had to put her down when she got cancer. When I was away, I had adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan. I came back and she went blind one day, and you said, I had gotten a spinal tap. You said, you need to get an MRI. And then when the results came in, you're the one who sat me down and said, Nicole, you got to do it. I always remember you for that with a very warm, because that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And I know you're a dog lover, and Sandy was my first baby, and it still hurts to this day, but I will always remember how wonderful you were, because it was killing me. And you gave me a little bit of tough love that day. And I still thank you for it.
Oh my God, I hope it wasn't too tough.
It was horrible.
That's a very hard thing, yeah.
Horrible. But Allison was a baby. We then had Sasha and Pooh. We now have Jackson. And, life goes on and 30 years pass. And Bob Ezrin, I can't thank you enough for coming on and spending this hour with me. It's been a real, real pleasure. I hope to see you again one of these days.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's, I'm sorry it's taken us so much time to get this together. It's just been an intensely crazy period since COVID. And hopefully things will start slowing down in a couple of years.
A couple of years. Well, it's good to keep, it's better to keep busy. Thank you. Thank you. What is your next project? What should we look out for from you?
Well, we've got, we've got a couple of Alice Coopers in the, in process. There's a large, very well-known band whose last album I worked on, and I think it's coming out in the spring. I'm not entirely sure. There's more Deep Purple coming. Wow. There's an Alice Cooper film, but also a film I did with a photographer, Edward Bertinsky, called In the Wake of Progress, which is about the environment. That's something that I'm, you know, intensely focused on.
Good. Thank you.
Being an environmental activist now. And so there's all that stuff and then some.
Okay. Well, I will look out for it and hopefully we stay in touch. And it was just so great to catch up with you. Thank you again.
And you too.
What a treat that was. I hope you enjoyed it even a bit as much as I did. There's so much we didn't get to, including Bob Ezrin's school, the Nimbus School of Recording Arts in Vancouver. It's just one of many, many projects he's involved with. Bob Ezrin, truly a legend. All right, with that, we're done. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday.